Just in time. All right. Let's start with a word of prayer. Can I get a brother to lead us in that tonight?
Also, then, all wise God, we thank you for blessing us to come back out to study another portion of your word. We ask that you would bless us to calm our minds in, that we may understand and participate in what Jeff had for us today. And we pray that you give him a recollection of the things that he studied, that he may be part of to us, that may the least to the greatest may be able to understand. And in Jesus Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
All right. Well, this is Isaiah. It is Sunday and Wednesday. Part of the reason why I lobbied for Sunday and Wednesday was the goal in this class is to try to get all the way through the text. I've already had my beloved coworker next door asking people to kind of pick how far they think I'm going to get. I guess that's just the kind of coworker he is. He says somewhere to 30-something chapters. We're going to spite him and get to 66. Yes. That was just about spiting David. It's not about really finishing. The goal is, that's why I asked that this class could be a Sunday, Wednesday class, because that's going to be challenging enough to give an honest read of the 66 chapters and still get through in 12 to 13 weeks, even Sunday, Wednesday. But it was hopeless with only 12 sessions. So, anyways. Isaiah is a big book. It is 66 chapters. How many of you have studied Isaiah before? Most people have been through it some fashion. So those of you who maybe have some exposure to the book, when you think of Isaiah, what's in there? What kind of things are we getting into in this book?
Prophecies.
Do prophecies. Any kind of particular prophecies or just
like Jesus?
Yeah, it's very messianic. Isaiah and the book of Psalms are the two most quoted books in the Old Testament. And so certainly the apostles and the guidance of the Spirit saw great significance in this book, in particular among the Old Testament books. There's a lot, and it's a big book, but there's a lot of the messianic future in the book. What else? What else goes on in this book?
God's judgment.
Yeah. So the fun thing about Isaiah is... fluorescent or black? Okay. And a Sharpie that should not be here.
You're not a fluorescent kind of guy.
No, well, there's always complaints when I... Always complaints when I use fluorescent anyways. All right. So one of the things about Isaiah that's interesting, Glenda mentioned judgment, Brother Olds, Lawrence mentioned messianic. Isaiah kind of works in three different time frames. Isaiah himself lived when? Anybody kind of remember when Isaiah lives? Say again? He lives in the days of Ahaz and Hezekiah. He lives in the 8th century. Okay, that's when he lives. But one of the things that makes Isaiah unique, I like to call Isaiah the book where God showed one man everything that he's up to. There will certainly be, moral issues raised by the book. You know, God is very upset about how his people live, their moral lives. The book has some of the best takedowns of idolatry in all of the Old Testament. And in particular, the way it doesn't just condemn idolatry. It gets into the very nature of idolatry. And then again, that's why we want to go slower than read and discern and kind of get what Isaiah is getting at. He doesn't just, criticize or condemn idolatry. He gets into the underlying logic and how foolish it is. Isaiah has some of the strongest revelation of God's nature, particularly as creator. Whenever you think about, the revelation of God as creator, think about Genesis. And certainly, there is a lot of significance to be derived out of Genesis 1 and 2 and God's work as creator. But Isaiah, perhaps, has some of the strongest and most vivid development of the nature of God as creator and how completely other he is. And he'll, in the 40-something chapters, which despite the pessimists, we will get to, God willing. In those 40-something chapters, there are some of the strongest developments of his nature. To what will you liken me? To whom will you compare me? The whole idea is there is no analogy for me. And since it's why God always said, the first commandment was, know what God's before me. The second commandment was, thou shalt not make graven image. And some of you have heard this before, but maybe for those of you who haven't, if you go back and you read that commandment, part of what God will go on to say is when we hear that, what we think is, well, don't make a Baal or an Ashtaroth or a, and he certainly, God intended for them not to do that. But he'll also go on and say, don't make an image of me. Why? Well, Isaiah helps us understand why that was that way. To what would you liken me? To what can you compare me? If you can draw me, depict me, sculpt me in any way, envision me, your idea of me is way too small. And so, again, Isaiah will, as when we get to the heart of the book, go deep into the imponderable, unfathomable nature of God. There simply is no analogy. There is nothing by which you can look at and say, that's God. You can look at things and say, it's kind of like that in one aspect of God. The sun is like his glory or, something. But there simply is no analogy for God in creation. And when you lose sight of that, you wind up with idolatry and some other things. Isaiah will walk us through all that when we get there. But one of the other big things that's easily missed in Isaiah, even when you get aside from the moral stuff, when you get aside from the deep, deep revelation of the nature of God and the nature of idolatry as the alternative to God, the counterfeiting of God, one of the things that you get into is the meaning of history. Isaiah is, in a sense, a philosophy of history. That's easy to miss when we only look at certain messianic prophecies. You just look at Isaiah 7 and the virgin birth or something like that. It's easy to miss that part of what God was actually doing when you look at Isaiah all the way across from chapter 1 to chapter 66 is he's unpacking a philosophy of history. What I mean by that is God is showing Isaiah what he's up to and what it all means and where it's all headed. And that's the thing is Isaiah, in the one sense, as one writer somewhere else put it, God shows Isaiah from creation to the day of eternity. God shows Isaiah everything. God reveals the whole arc to Isaiah over the course of the book. And so one of the things I hope we walk away from when we hit Thanksgiving and the end of November and this quarter's over is that maybe you've had a taste of that or begin to see that. Maybe you don't grasp all of it yet, but at least you recognize that Isaiah is up to something really, really big in that regard. And so part of the way that plays out for Isaiah is he himself lived during the Assyrian period. That was the great enemy of Israel. That was the means by which God either brought judgment to the north or was threatening judgment on the south. And Isaiah is a southern prophet. He is affiliated with Jerusalem. He is in the court of the Davidic kings. That's where you're going to find him. And so he lives in this era, and that's where he lives. But again, part of what God is up to, and this is part of why modern scholars don't believe in the inspiration of Isaiah, because God showed him too much and too much detail too far down the road, and we all know that's a mark of writing it after the fact, not actually predicting it. And so most, and if you've read a modern commentary, or maybe depending on where you've been in the past, or what you've listened to in the past, modern scholars will talk about three Isaiahs. Isaiah of Jerusalem, the guy who actually really did live in his time and wrote about the Assyrian stuff, but there's just no way, when God has Isaiah call Cyrus by name, two centuries ahead of schedule, there's just, there's no way. That's a later guy. We call him Second Isaiah because we don't know what his name was, so Second Isaiah. And then there's a third Isaiah in which, and generally the trick is, I don't buy into that. I think it's all Isaiah. I think God showed him everything. But their breaks that they typically make are correct, that in terms of the structure of the book, and we'll talk more about structure Wednesday night, but Isaiah 1 through 39 is kind of the Assyrian era, Isaiah 40 to 55, you don't have to write this down, we'll have something on Wednesday night about this, but we'll talk more about the nature of the structure then. But Isaiah 40 through 55 is Second Isaiah, just too much of the Babylonian future in there. It has to be written after the fact in Isaiah's voice. And then Third Isaiah, or Trito Isaiah, for those of you who want to show up at the next party. But but which focuses more on the deep future and the messianic future. And again, that's just too much. That's more, you know, post-exilic, when they began to really look for the, you know, some Davidic son to come and deliver them from this, you know, the Persians and then the Greeks and then the Romans. That got scribbled out way further down the field. But the trick is, Isaiah is very much himself the man. God is moving him among these eras. He lives here. God shows him an awful lot about what's coming here. And then ultimately, God shows him the messianic future, not just the coming of the Messiah on earth, but even parts of what we would now call the second coming, and the impact of the second coming. Because one of the things that, and this is why the Jews mangled their expectations of Jesus so badly, they looked at Old Testament messianic prophecy and thought of the Christ of fulfilling it all at once. What we now know is the Christ will fulfill his messianic prophecy in the first and a second coming. And so parts of what we now know is the second coming, when he will fix all things, when he will set everything to rights, when he will crush the nations in judgment. That's, you know, we were going to, that's going to be at the end of the world. That's going to be when he comes back. The Jews thought he would do it all at once. And so when Jesus shows up and says, I'm not going to do that now, they get really upset and decide to get rid of him. And he says, my kingdom's not of this world. They read it all together. And so part of the mistake that we still make is not recognizing that God really does kind of talk in a messianic key. We rightly recognize, knowing what we know now, there are two comings of Jesus to accomplish all of it. But in the Old Testament, God really did just kind of slam it all together and talk about it as kind of one big thing. Because remember, to God, 1,000 years is as a day, and a day is as 1,000 years. We're the ones who get bent up about the chronology. God just looks at it in terms of stuff I promised to do. When he does it and how he does it, that's his business. We get into trouble when we try to pull out a calendar and say here, here, and here. Does that make sense? And by the way, that's what people are still doing with the second coming today when they try to date it. Don't do that. That's why it's the last days in the New Testament. Paul talks about it being the last days. Not the last days because chronologically, you know, the world's only got 3 months left. It's because chronologically, God has done everything short of the second coming that he's talked about. Make sense? And so that's why it's the last days. God talks about things in terms of logical sequence, not chronological sequence. You get the distinction? The Jews didn't. And to be honest, a lot of people who claim to be Christians today don't, which is why we have dispensationalism and a whole bunch of other things. Let me get Dale, and then I'll get David. Yes, sir?
I've since lost it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Too much too fast. David.
That viewpoint, is that from historical writings we know that they had a different viewpoint? The viewpoint you just expressed, that's what their problem was.
Oh, the Jews?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, basically their expectations. Most, to the extent that we have intertestamental Jewish writings, they were hoping for, you know, the Son of David to come crush things and deliver them from the Romans. They could not imagine a kingdom out of this world.
Well, I know that part, but I'm talking about the specifics you mentioned about two.
The closest group, ironically, here's the thing, the group that got it the closest was the Qumran community. They solved it not with two comings, they solved it with two messiahs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But they rightly recognized that there's so much going on in this messianic material that's coming down to them. They wouldn't call it messianic in the way that we think of it now, but this coming deliverer. And they rightly recognized that there were some tensions and even some apparent contradictions. So they were the ones who came the closest to recognizing God's got to be up to something other than everybody else just simply saying, Son of David's going to come and do all of this in one big, bold, you know, event.
That might explain why, even though they had plenty of evidence still, why they didn't believe so much in Jesus.
Well, correct, that's it.
Because he wasn't that.
He wasn't the all-in-one Messiah.
It was the other point that you're just making. I can see why they would at least be tempted to think for that reason specifically also that you mentioned.
And that's what's interesting is, as far as we have of what's come down to us, especially in intertestamental Jewish writings, nobody cracked the code. Qumran community came the closest in some ways, which also was interesting. They were the rebels. That's why they were out at the Dead Sea. They had given up on the whole Jerusalem system. It was hopelessly corrupt. We have nothing left to do if we want to remain pure and holy except go out and sit by the Dead Sea and wait for the Messiah to come up. And what's interesting, the choice about that is, again, even in Isaiah chapter 40, the voice of one, behold the voice of one crying in the, where's the Messiah going to show up first? In the wilderness. And by the way, curiously, where was Jesus first publicly revealed? Baptized at the Jordan. Debates about the exact location, but if it's not in Galilee, it's right there close to the Dead Sea. In fact, there is a shrine there today that some religious groups have built honoring Jesus' baptism there. There are two competing locations. But one of the possible locations is there right as the Jordan dumps into the Dead Sea. That's certainly where John the Baptist was known to be knocking around from other geographical references we have. And so the Qumran community, rightly in that sense, literally showed up in the wilderness. And so they went out to wait. Jerusalem was hopeless. By the way, just, you know, David's question raises a real interesting thing. Even his own disciples, remember, didn't get it even when he tried to explain it to them. You know, three times on the journey to Jerusalem, depending on which synoptic account you're or which account you're in, but basically three times Jesus will say, I'm going to Jerusalem. They're going to put the Son of Man to death. 3 days later, he's going to be raised from the dead. And of course, most famously, the Matthew 16 account of that, Peter says, no, not going to happen. And even to the point of, despite all these explanations, when you get to Gethsemane and they show up to arrest Jesus, what does Peter do? First,
he fights.
It's a holy war.
Yeah, it's a holy war. That's right. And so part of the thing of that, I think God does it this way, to be honest, so that no man may boast. That nobody can sit there and say, I got it. I got it all figured out. I cracked the code. You should have listened to me. Because one of my favorite New Testament passages showing just kind of the revelation that the resurrection was, Luke chapter 24. His disciples don't get it. Nobody's getting it. And keep in mind, this is just a really good detour here for a minute. The morning of resurrection, why were there women at the tomb? Think about this. Why were there women at the tomb? They didn't go to meet the resurrected Lord for the Easter service.
They came to take their body.
What were they expecting to be in the tomb? Despite everything that had been said, what were they expecting? They were expecting his own followers, devoted as they were. We're expecting a body. When the women go back and tell the men, he's not there. Do they say, of course, silly women, didn't you listen to believe? No, that's not what they said. What do Peter and John do?
They run to the tomb.
They have the first Easter 5K. That's exactly what they do. They run there. Why? Because they did not initially believe. Okay? No. Nobody, even his own people who were told repeatedly, this is actually how it's going to play out. Watch. They went to anoint a corpse. Luke 24 is still Resurrection Sunday, later today. This is unique to Luke, but I love this passage because I think it gets at something important. Luke chapter 24. This is unique to Luke's gospel. Some of you heard me talk about this before, but for those who haven't, bear with us here then. It's the story of the trip to the road to Emmaus, remember? It's been a crazy Sunday. Now rumors are swirling. It's a little chaotic because what's the word rapidly? That's kind of spreading around town now. The tomb is empty. The Roman guards have gone and said, so think about it. Everybody in Jerusalem now, there's stuff going around and people are trying to figure out what's going on. Because, by the way, the soldiers saying the disciples stole the body, what are they still admitting? They're still admitting the tomb's empty. Nobody ever denied that. Moderns deny that. Swoon theory, all these other theories. In the ancient world, nobody ever denied the tomb was empty. It was just how you're going to explain it. But the tomb was empty. So you got these two guys walking back to Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. It's been quite a Sunday. And they were talking with each other, verse 14, about the things that had happened. They were talking and discussing when Jesus himself drew near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him at first. Now, throughout the Gospels, by the way, this is why we never finish Isaiah. but this really is a teachable moment because this really is a fair point. throughout the gospel, sight is used as a metaphor, not just for physical illness, but for what?
Insight.
Insight. You don't get it. Who gets it versus who doesn't get it? The most blind people are those who say they see, if I could paraphrase Jesus loosely, and so forth. And Jesus even worked a miracle, particularly Mark's accounting of it, really, really powerfully, where he healed blind people in two stages. And the point, and by the way, and that parable is done in the context of his trip, his final trip to Jerusalem. That's important too. And he does it in two stages. Remember, the first time he heals, or kind of does a, what we call a little healing on the men, and he asks them, you know, they're asked, what do you see? And they say, we see men walking around like trees. That's not Jesus having a bad miracle day. That's Jesus doing something. What's the point? Part of the impact of his work, even upon those who do want to see, is you only see kind of a, you know, you see better, but not clearly yet. Then he does it again. Now they see. It's kind of what Jesus is doing through this crucifixion, resurrection of it, even with his own people. Do his disciples believe he is the Messiah, the Son of God? Yes, they do. They see him walking around like trees. Do they understand what he's really here to do and what his kingdom's really about yet?
Not a chance.
No, they do not. That's right. Not a chance. That's why Peter's waving a sword badly in Gethsemane and hacking people's ears off. He wasn't aiming for the ear, folks. You know that. That's just what happens when it's amateur hour. So, here they are. They're walking back. Jesus shows up, but they don't see, and that's part of the point. And people speculate, well, is it because he was resurrected from the dead? He has a different... No, you're missing the point. The point is they don't see because they don't see yet. That's the point. Don't worry about the what-ifs. Their eyes were kept from recognizing him. Verse 17, and he said to them, what is this conversation you were holding with each other while you walk? And they stood still, looking sad. Why are they looking sad? Well, they were true believers who are disappointed. One of them named Cleopas answered him, are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days? That's one of my favorite lines in all the Bible. Asking Jesus, don't you know what happened? You know, this, yeah, talk about, I'm pretty sure he knows. And he said to them, what things? He plays along. Now we're into David's favorite book, Tactics. You know, ask questions, draw it out of them. What things? And they said to them, concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and crucified. Look at what they say next, though, verse 21. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. That's an interesting way to phrase it. What are they saying?
But he wasn't. He
failed.
We had hoped. That's why a couple of verses before they looked sad. All these rumors going around, which side did they listen to, apparently? Which side of the story are they buying into?
The soldiers.
Stolen or whatever, or you know, like so many people today, the religious world is so confusing, who knows what to believe. But the bottom line is, they've given up. They wanted to believe, they had followed, they were on Jesus' side in all of this, but with what's happened, they've given up. So, verse 22, moreover, some of the women of our company, because that's the thing, they were disciples. And by the way, another sidebar, we forget, it wasn't just the 12 who followed Jesus all the way to the end. We forget that sometimes. In the book of Acts, Acts chapter 1, when Jesus ascends, he leaves behind not just the 12. How many people were in the upper room?
120.
That's still not much, but it's not 12 either. And we forget that sometimes. And by the way, part of the when they had to pick Judas as replacement, one of the conditions was who has followed us the whole time. And they could. They had a couple of candidates. It was not always just the 12. We forget that sometimes. Maybe a very small band at times, but it was not just the 12. All right.
And mainly women.
Well, that's the other side part. That's right. Women. Women who, and it was the women at the cross, or it was the women at the tomb. That's exactly right. Anyways, some of our women on verse 22 amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning. They did not find the body. They came back saying that they didn't even see a vision of angels who said that he was alive. And some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as one had said, but him they did not see, which means they left town too early. Anyways, he said to them, O foolish ones. Now look at what he says. O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ, the Messiah, should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. Which presumably probably would have been some of Isaiah. But bottom line is, part of what I think that story shows is that even those who were inclined to believe, who were sympathetic, who followed all through all kinds of trials and seasons, it took the crucifixion and the resurrection of it itself to kind of begin to unlock the significance of what had been revealed. And again, why does God do it that way? So that no man may boast. So that no man may boast. And by the way, what's the takeaway of all that for us today? People who think they can read the second coming and predict in great detail exactly what it's going to look like or what heaven's going to be like or etc. Don't do that. We've already seen how it turned out with the first coming. Don't do that. What you will be able to do when you get there is look back at the words of God and say, of course, how could I not have seen that once it happens? But I fully expect that there are going to be aspects of the second coming in heaven that we're so sure we've got it all figured out, and we're singing about our pearly gates and our golden gates and all of that, and we're going to be surprised how God actually fulfilled it or what it actually was. Be careful. You look forward in hope. As David reminded us this morning, God is faithful. He will keep every word of it. It will be abundant. You know, it will be better than you ever hoped for. Or you could have imagined one of my favorite lines about God's power, Ephesians 3. Paul says, to him who can do more, or abundantly more than you can ask or even think. My paraphrase, but you get the point. You can't even begin to imagine. And now we're back to Isaiah. To what would you liken me? You can't begin to imagine who I am and what I'm capable of. You can't begin to imagine who I am and what I'm capable of. All of our creativity is inside the box. When you stop and think about all human creativity, all our artistry, all our engineering, all our thinking, we work inside the box. We take existing concepts, existing images, existing ideas, and we rearrange them. We put a horn on a horse and say, oh, a unicorn, how creative. But it's just a horse. We tinker with it. Who thought up of a horse when there was none? And that's the point. However creative you are, you always think inside the box. That's the problem with idolatry. And we're a little ahead of ourselves, we'll get there. That's the problem with idolatry in a nutshell. All you do is think inside the box with your gods. That's why God says, don't even try to, even if it's me, don't try to sculpt me. Don't do that. You have no idea what a God outside the box can do. And that's why God's preferred name for himself in Isaiah, very common. Anybody know what it is?
I am.
On the right track, but not quite. The Holy One of Israel. That's a very common self-designation God uses. And what does holiness mean first and foremost? It's not moral first and foremost. What does holiness really mean?
Set apart.
I am the Holy One of Israel. When Isaiah encounters God, he thought he was going to the regular temple. And we miss it sometimes. He goes to the regular temple, Isaiah 6, all of a sudden turns into the real temple. And what does he hear being chanted? Holy, holy, holy. That's a key part of this book's vision of God. You cannot begin to imagine who you're dealing with. Which means y'all going back to now, y'all be obeying. That's why he's angry. But you cannot begin to imagine who you're dealing with. Yes, ma'am.
I think for me, it's limits of my faith.
Like, say again, I'm sorry.
For me, it's limits of my faith. Like hearing David this morning, do I really trust to let go of all the human limits that we put on who God is? And to just, it's almost like you have to just take a dive into the, not unknown, but, you know, to really let go and fully believe that he is able to do.
Yes.
And we think he's going to provide this and this, but he's capable of so much more than what we even
ask when that's it. And it's funny you say that, Tanuvia, because, and this will be probably either week two or week three, because I have to do a little bit of the book out of orders. I want to get some, there are some passages and points in the book that are pillars to getting this larger point. And one of the first pillars is God is most frustrated with his people because they don't trust him. He's got a track record. By the way, I mean, and that's part of why God was so impressed with Abraham. Because you know, when God comes to Abraham and says, here's the deal. Here's what I want you to do, and you know, this is what we can do for you. Does God have a track record he points to and said, you know, I mean, well, I flooded the world once. That was impressive. But you know, what does God have to offer Abraham in terms of covenants kept? or, you know, risk everything and I will bail you. He does not have this big book that we have now. That's part of what I think God loved about that man. That man was simply willing, on the basis of God being God, to take a walk. Risk everything. You know, then we sit there and say, well, you know, the worst happens, he goes back there. You don't understand what it was like to travel in the ancient world, leave yourself at the risk of being slaughtered by the natives, the pagans. I mean, you know, we really don't understand the risk he took in that world to do what he did. Because we're used to, you know, well, if it doesn't work out, you just go home and live in your parents' basement. No, that's not how it worked back then. That's not how it worked back then. You don't move 500 miles plus across the desert into an area. I mean, and understand, even a couple, you know, 150 years down the road, Jacob is upset with his sons when they antagonize the men of Shechem, because what can the locals do still even then to them? Come wipe us out. What were you guys thinking, Levi and Simeon, when you went over to Shechem and did that? Don't you realize they can come slaughter us all? Abram says, welcome to my world. There's a risk. So yeah, so anyways, that's what God is looking for. That's been always, you know, we talk about faith in three aspects. There's the intellectual part. Do you believe that certain things that God has said are true? Jesus is the Son of God being the biggest one today. You know, and then there's the faith as you believe enough to obey. And so, you know, you if you believe he's the Son of God, you're baptized, forgives of your sins. It leads to an action. But what God is also still just as much looking for is the trust. That is just as much a part of what God is looking for. The trust, even among those who have already intellectually believed and obeyed different aspects. Because being baptized is one thing. You know, trusting God in dark and dangerous seasons of life is a whole different thing. You know, when the diagnosis is bad, when the finances are hopeless, when something bad is going on with one of your children, you know, whatever it may be, that's a whole different issue. And that's where we find out real quick. And we'll get to that rapidly in this book, because that is foundation, one of God's big issues. Those who do not trust in God build idols, because we want something to trust in. And that's part of the role of idolatry in this book, when you draw the lines all the way through. But God rapidly, early in the book, brings up the issue of trust. You guys don't trust me, that's your problem. And that's why you want an idol. Because an idol is a God you can control. A God is an idol that will, I mean, we think we do anyways, because the truth of the matter is Baal didn't solve the drought problem. But we do in our silly little foolish human hearts, we like idols because we feel like we're more in control of them, which makes me feel more in control of my predicament. You know, and so today, my first inclination is to trust the doctor, not the Almighty. Right? My first inclination is to trust the financial advisor who's going to tell me how to fix my investments or save my retirement or whatever, not the Almighty who said, the righteous don't starve. Just be honest. And Isaiah is going to go there. And he's going to make it a very big deal. God knows the problem with his people is we say the right things. And that's actually going to come up rapidly too. You say the right things, but you don't live the right things, not just morally. You don't live the right things in terms of, I know your heart. You don't really trust in me right now. You're afraid, and you're giving me your fear. So anyways, that'll be either second or third week. We'll see how fast we move. So far, not good. What I want to do today, we've got about 20, 18 minutes left. Let me do this. One of the reasons we don't like the prophets and we stay away from the prophets is because they're weird and they're different. They talk in poetry. Who does that? We're not a poetic people. That makes it hard. And then the next thing is they assume a lot of their history and their culture, and we don't know that. After that, it's just kind of all lost. So what I want to do is I want to give you kind of three ways of conceptualizing the prophets. I'm going to move really, really fast. And one says you don't need to know all of this to do Isaiah, and I don't know if I have time this week, maybe I'll make Hunter make this into a sheet for me or something. No, I, but my regular secretary is going on vacation, but he really is the graphic of the two of us. He does this stuff. I don't. You've seen my slides. But the prophets kind of work. There are three things to understand about the prophets. Number one, where did it come? Three. First thing is to understand that what they really are is that they are covenant enforcers. That's what they do. They talk and they think they condemn, they judge, or they encourage in covenantal language. And so the trick when you're reading them is to figure out which, we use a musical analogy, which key they're in, which covenant are they talking in terms of? Are they talking in terms of the Abrahamic covenant? Are they talking in terms of the Mosaic covenant? Are they talking in terms of the Davidic covenant? Are they talking in terms of, still off in the distance, but the new covenant? You got to figure out which key they're singing in, which one they're talking about. Because what which covenant they're talking about determines in part what they're going to say and what they expect people to get out of what they're saying. Because, for instance, the Abrahamic covenant, what do humans have to do under the Abrahamic covenant?
Yeah,
but does that really put that puts individuals in jeopardy? Generally speaking, is Abraham's covenant already, God going to already have to keep that? Yeah, because ultimately it was on the basis of what Abraham did, not what his descendants did. Abraham took the walk, the promise was made. Now, you want in on it, personally, I recommend circumcision personally, at least for a season. But even that falls away because here's the thing, trick question, is Abraham's covenant still in effect? Someone be brave. Yes or no?
Yes.
Good job, young men. Yes. What does Paul say in Galatians? Who's the seed of Abraham today? Who's receiving the benefits of the Abrahamic covenant?
We are.
What was John the Baptist getting at when they walked around saying, we're children of Abraham? And John said, no. God can make children of Abraham out of stones if he needs to. Because what the Abrahamic covenant was about was the Abraham-shaped life. And so whether you read Romans 4 or whether you read Galatians, especially Galatians 2, 3, and 4, the Abrahamic covenant is still in force. Because ultimate upshot of the Abrahamic covenant was, you do this, Abraham, and yeah, there's going to be a seed, though Paul loves to play on that term, seed can be singular or plural. We think plural because we think of the nation, and God certainly in one sense didn't mean that for Abraham. But Paul plays and says also seed singular, one particular seed. This guy we call the Messiah or Jesus, absolutely. And through Jesus, does Abraham's seed just kind of, again, change key, but is Abraham's seed finding their life? Yes. And ultimately we find out that the land really wasn't the physical land of Israel. What does the Hebrew even talk about? Abraham wasn't really looking for land. Abraham was looking for a city. What city?
God's.
See, even Abraham understood on some level there was something bigger going on than just a nice piece of real estate, you know, and a bunch of kids and grandkids. And so we still live under that because ultimately, among those things, what was God's final word in Genesis 12? And through you, what? All nations of the world will what?
Be blessed.
That was the end game of it all. Through you, all, not just your descendants, all nations will be blessed. So yeah, this is still going on. This becomes the key of hope. This becomes the key of hope. One of them in the prophets. Because God has promises to keep no matter what you do under this one now. Now again, part of the mystery. How can God, you know, whose eyes are too holy to look upon evil, how can God deal with a very evil people? Well, Paul will help us solve some of that in the book of Romans. God figures out a way to be just and justifier in Jesus. You get, no one saw it coming. That's part of why even those who wanted to follow Jesus kind of stumbled over it. Nobody saw how God was going to be both just and justifier and keep all these words. Again, you don't want anybody boasting. You figured it out. The Mosaic Covenant, are there obligations for everybody under that one? Yeah. And so that's the tone in which most of the condemnation happens. That's where you're in trouble. And the greatest threat of the Mosaic Covenant was what? You lose the real estate. You'll go out of the land. That was the big threat there. Now the Davidic Covenant, was that, this was unilateral. Abraham did his part, now it's just all up to God. God's got promises to keep because Abraham checked the box, so to speak. Bilateral. God's got his obligations, you've got your obligations. You fail your obligations, does that give God an out? Technically, yes. In God's mercy, he doesn't take all of his options. But technically, yes. You fail your side of the covenant, God, in one sense, he is faithful in that he judged. He kicked you out of the land. But everybody's got responsibilities under this one, ongoing responsibilities. You got to worship the way you're supposed to. You got to, you know, eat the food laws, etc. Everybody's got ongoing responsibilities. The Davidic covenant, unilateral or bilateral? Unilateral.
Did you listen to David?
Bilateral to David.
Well, to David personally, but by the time but by the time God made it with David, the whole point was you've done enough, and now you have this. You will never lack a man to rule on your throne. In fact, God even makes explicit. I think David referred to this in his sermon this morning. If I remember, I was also sitting with two young girls. But God makes the point in 2 Samuel 7. Even if your son sins, I will not remove from him my chesed, my loving kindness, my loyalty, as I did to Saul. And of course, ultimately, we understand how God could do that. He could punish individual sons of David, and did, calling in the search of Jerusalem. But who's the son who will sit on David's throne forever? So God can't keep this promise. So when you're looking for hope again in the prophets, who are the prophets going to start talking about? A son of David. Hope.
I've never heard that word. I've never heard it talked about that way. David covenant.
Oh, really?
I guess.
Okay. Well, 2 Samuel 7, that's where there are a couple other places you find in the Old Testament. That's kind of the classic place to read it.
You know, the man after God's own heart and all that, but I've just never.
Yeah. Yeah, so part of what happens, though,
it's a new word to me.
the real quick, the Reader's Digest version, of course, David shows up, kills Goliath. God is, he's anointed to be Saul's successor, man after God's own heart. And David does things right that Saul did wrong, and in some ways that we easily miss sometimes. Saul very much ignored the prophets. The language of God, in the chapter where God ultimately rejects Saul completely, 1 Samuel 15, the language of Saul's heart is stunning. He demands that Samuel honor me before my people. Saul's kind of lost it. It's all about him. And the only reason that he needs Samuel, God's prophet, is for the photo op. Because you got a state religion. I got to look like Samuel on good terms. Behind closed doors, I'll read him the riot act. And as he does, you will come with me. You will honor me before my people. Complete loss of mind. And that's when God says, can't deal with this guy. David, for all his flaws, and he has flaws. Sometimes we whitewash a little bit David's flaws, but we miss the point. David knew who he was before God. And some ways to think about it. Is there any passage where Saul ever cheated on his wife? No. But it's a perfect example where certain moral standards do not undo the fact that the heart is rotten in an even more dangerous way. And that was Saul versus David. David certainly had his issues. We whitewash him too much sometimes. But what God saw in David, this goes back to the trust issue. What God saw in David was a man who knew that God was king and I may carry the earthly title, but I'm not that God. And so, for instance, first thing David does when he conquers Jerusalem, which Saul and others had never been able to do, he brings the ark to Jerusalem. Why does he do that? What's he saying when he does that? This isn't my capital. Who's the king here? This is God's place. And in particular, when God will make this covenant with him, David goes from not just kind of enthroning God in Jerusalem once he has it, but then basically sitting around saying, it's still in a tent. I've got a nice house. That's not right. I'm going to build a temple. And God shows up and says, you're too bloody from the wars you fought to do that for me. But I appreciate the, basically, I appreciate the heart of that, so I'm going to build a house for you. And it doesn't always come out in English translations, but there's a great pun in Hebrew there. You wanted to build a house for me, but instead I'm going to build a house for you, is what he says for him. And that's his family culminating in the Messiah. But again, even the Bible, by the way, your question, David, even the Bible, inspired writers by inspiration raise the issue of how's God going to keep this word. Psalm 89 teases on that a little bit. I don't think David got to that as much this morning, but the psalmist will basically say, after having hymned God's faithfulness in the Davidic covenant, how are you going to keep it now? And in particular, Jeremiah chapter 22, God, right before Jerusalem falls, God has so had it with the last three kings, the last one in particular, the one we call Jehoiachin, which is a horrible transliteration. But anyways, because it's not Chin, it's Kin. Like Caribbean. Anyways, he says, though Coniah, one of his other names, was a signet ring on my hand, this last Jewish king. Zedekiah was a puppet. That's why he's not in Jesus' genealogy, by the way. Zedekiah really is the last king, and Jehoiakim is. Zedekiah is a puppet. Go read the genealogies of Jesus. Anyways, though he were a signet ring on my hand, there was a symbol of my own name and authority. I'm going to take it off and throw him away. And then he goes on, he says, write this man off as childless. Now, was Jehoiachin literally childless? No, because eventually Jesus comes through him. He was not literally childless. What does God mean? He says, write him off as childless. I'm not going to recognize these descendants in this way anymore. And in fact, the next line is, never again will a man prosper sitting on the throne of David in Jerusalem. So even in the inspired writings, you've got a conundrum. Well, wait a second. Wait a second. How can that be? Well, Jesus comes and says, I got David's throne, but it's not a kingdom of this world. I can't do that. Nobody saw it coming. So God's up the four-dimensional chess here is what he's doing with three-dimensional people who can't think outside the sandbox, which is why God says you need to trust me and follow me. I alone know what's really going on. I really know what I'm up to. You guys got to quit trying to think for yourselves and just follow me. Yes, ma'am.
Is that part of what you said, just because you're of the seed does not mean you're part of the promise?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. And that's part of, as we transition to the new covenant real quick, part of what I think the new covenant's getting at when, well, here, just look in your own Bibles real quick. Go to Jeremiah 31. By the way, we like Jeremiah 31 as a passage for the new covenant, and certainly we use it also because the Hebrew writer quotes it as new covenant. But there are other passages that express the gist of the new covenant, both in Isaiah and in Ezekiel. But this is kind of our preferred formulation. And so, in fact, we'll talk about that when we get to that part of Isaiah. But anyways, Jeremiah 31. Isaiah 31, I really meant... Where did it go? There it is, 31, and verse 31. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day I took them by hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant they broke. And by the way, right there, the new covenant replaces not this one and this one. When he says that, what does he tell you he's replacing? He's replacing this one. Because we're still living under this one. We are children of Abraham. And again, go back and read Galatians, Paul's letter to Galatians, middle of that letter. That's what Paul is saying. God has kept his covenant. Abraham's descendants, as numerous as the seashore, that wasn't ethnic Jews, though righteous Jews who were saved could be part of that. He's also talking about us. We're part of that group. The Davidic covenant is still under force. It's still under force right now.
It's permanently under force.
Permanently under force, that's right. So this one's not going away, this one's not going away. Which one can go away? And that's what he's talking about. It's going to, so I'm going to do something different, but part of what makes it different, keep reading now. Keep reading. It's not going to be like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. And look at the first thing he says. I will put my law within them. I will write it on their hearts. Where was the first covenant written? Tablets of stone. Paul makes a big deal about that in 2 Corinthians. That's another class, another quarter. But that's where it was. And so look what he says coming out of this. Verse 34. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me from the least to the greatest, declares the Lord. So here's how it works now. Well, I know we're in trouble. But here's how it works now. Old covenant, you didn't choose to be a Jew. You were born Jewish. And then what did your mom and dad have to do? They had to take the covenant written on stone outside you and teach it into you. And you had to internalize it and obey it if Israel was going to last from generation to generation. You see that? Does that make sense? You're not born Christian. You're not born under the covenant of Christ. How do you get there? Because you hear the law, take it in, accept it, obey it, and put yourself under the covenant. So that by definition, if you are in this covenant, the law is already inside. By definition, I don't have to go to you and say, know the Lord, Brother Bates, because you already know him if you're here. That's why you're here. People that be taught to know the Lord under Judaism. They were born to it. They were born under the covenant. They had to be taught into the covenant then. And that's part of, to be fair, that's part of how the covenant kept breaking down. Because transmission from generation to generation is pretty tricky. Those of us who raise kids know that. But this is going to be something fundamentally different because God has no grandchildren ultimately. If you are in this covenant, It's because you said, I want to be one of these people. So the law starts on the inside. And I don't have to go to any of the rest of God's covenant people now and say, no, the Lord, because by definition, if you are one of the God's covenant people, it's because you chose to be, not by birth, but by intelligent decisions. By the way, this is why you can't baptize babies. Because babies can't do this. That is an old covenant, Old Testament way of thinking about how parents to children and the faith is transmitted. You can't do that. The very essence of the new covenant is people have to be old enough and able to take this inside and choose this for themselves so that I don't have to tell my son, know the Lord, you know, even though he was baptized as a baby. You with me? Make sense? All right. Well, we are stuck there for tonight. I'll see you Wednesday night, and we'll try to do more.
How long after Isaiah...